that now, and again, it will be informal, so everybody is welcome to interrupt the speaker when a question comes up.
Yes.
We start with Daniel Mack's talk on an alternative model for plasma battery regulation of single channel gate.
Thank you. Good morning, and I would like to thank the organizer for giving me this opportunity to talk about the allosteric model that we have developed for the regulation of the IP3 receptor single channel gating by its ligand calcium and IP3. First, I would like to acknowledge the people who have contributed significantly to the project. Professor Foskett, my boss, who has been working with me right from the beginning of the project. Sean McBride is a technician in the Foskett lab. He took most of the, a significant portion of the data that I'm presenting today. He has since gone on to study in medical school, so his job has been taken over by Natalia Petrenko, who has taken some of the data I'm presenting as well. Finally, Professor Horrigan, who has given us useful ideas and discussions during the development of the model. The talk is going to be divided into three main parts. First, I'll give a brief background on the IP3 receptor and the experimental technique that we use to study its single channel activity, the nuclear patch clamping. The background part I'm going to go over very briefly because we have been given very good introduction to the IP3 receptor yesterday. Make my job easier at this part at least. Then I'm going to go over the experimental observations. There are four sets. First, the regulation of the IP3 receptor channel activity by the cytoplasmic calcium concentration. Secondly, the effect of the IP3 concentration on the cytoplasmic side on the activity of the channel. Third is a spontaneous IP3 receptor channel activity that we observe in the total absence of any activating ligand. And finally, I would like to talk about the activity of the channel after it has been exposed to an ultra-low calcium concentration. Finally, I would like to present a model to account for all the experimental observations that I'll talk about. Yes, you can see there's a wide diversity of experimental observations. So, I would like to, with your indulgence, go over these rather at a slower pace so that at least these can be told in a sort of more distinguished from one set to the next. So if you have any questions when I'm talking about these observations and the model, please interrupt. Do. So the IP3 receptor is an intracellular calcium release channel, or rather like the ryanodine receptor. It's been found in all the cell type that has been studied so far, and it's localized mainly to the endoplasmic reticular membrane. So it's involved in regulating the calcium signaling in mammalian cell, frog cells, in different kinds of organs, the central nervous system, the liver. So actually, I don't think I've found a cell type that has been said that naturally does not express any IP3 receptor. Actually, that is a problem because if you want to know background so that you can express exogenous IP3 receptor, it's difficult. So it's a blessing or a curse, depending on what you want to do. Sorry? It may not be. I mean, by cell type, I mean animal cell type. Yeah, plant cells have them as well. I don't know about yeast, whether there is any equivalent. Sorry?
Red blood cells?
Maybe you can, you can't. I don't know. but then you can't express much in the red blood cell, so that doesn't help. Then the regulation of the IP3 is involved receptor is involved in regulating calcium signal in a wide range of cell processes like secretion, gene expression, apoptosis, development of long-term depression in nervous system. So because of its location in the endoplasmic reticulum, it has been difficult to study single channel properties of the IPC receptor in its native endoplasmic reticular membrane environment. Our group has noticed that the endoplasmic reticular membrane is topologically connected to the continuous with the outer membrane of nucleus in the cell. So if we can isolate the nucleus from the cell, we can patch clamp its outer membrane as a surrogate for the endoplasmic reticular membrane. And we expect that the channel that is found in the endoplasmic reticular membrane should also be found in the outer nuclear membrane as well. The cell that we've decided to use is the oocytes from a Xenopus frog. There are two reasons for the choice. First, the cell is huge. Even the isolated nucleus from a mature oocyte is about 300 to 500 microns across in diameter. And so it can be easily manually isolated from the oocyte with minimal mechanical damage to the structure. Also, the oocyte is bound to express only the type 1 IPS receptor isoform in any significant amount. So if we look at an IPS receptor in the isolated oocyte nucleus, we can be sure that it's the type 1 IPS receptor that we are looking at. Here is a picture of the experimental setup, low resolution. The here is a isolated oocyte nucleus in a sitting in a bath, and here is a micropipette positioned adjacent to it to perform the patch clamp experiment. Here is a schematic diagram of the experimental setup in a higher magnification. So here is the isolated nucleus sitting in a bath solution, so that the cytoplasmic side of any channel that is present in the isolated nucleus outer membrane is exposed to the bath solution before we do any patch clamp experiment. The patch clamp experiment is done by positioning the micropipette so that its tip comes into contact with the outer membrane of the isolated nucleus. Then we applied a little bit of suction inside the patch pipette so that we isolated a patch of the outer nuclear membrane into the pipette. Hopefully, if everything goes right, then a gigaohm seal will be formed between the isolated nuclear membrane patch and the wall of the tip of the micropipette. In this configuration, the cytoplasmic side of any channel that is inside this isolated membrane patch will face into the pipette. So by vigorously controlling the composition, by vigorously controlling the composition of the solution that we use inside the pipette, we can study the single channel activity of the channel inside the isolated membrane patch in a steady state condition under various kinds of ligand concentration.
Just a trivial question, how can the bath solution be very different from the pipette solution?
The bath... Well, actually, the suction is applied after the tip comes into contact, so there should be a minimal amount of bath solution taken into the pipette. Actually, to prevent the diffusion of bath solution into the pipette solution, we actually applied a positive pressure when we are positioning the pipette in place. So. And I would also point out that in our experiment, it's the electrical current that is passing through from the pipette through the isolated nuclear membrane patch that we are monitoring. So first set of experimental observations that I would like to talk about concerns the regulation of the activity of the IP3 receptor by cytoplasmic calcium concentration. Just in case, when I talk about calcium concentration and IP3 concentration, most of the case, unless expressly stated otherwise, is the cytoplasmic concentration that I'm talking about. So here is a current trace that we obtained. And in this set of experiment, the nucleus is isolated directly into a regular bath solution, a standard bath solution with 450 nanomolar free calcium concentration. And the arrow there indicates the level of current when the channel that is in the isolated nuclear patch is closed. And as the channel opens, the amount of current that can pass through the isolated nuclear patch increases. So we see an upward deflection of the current. And when the channel closes, the current returns to its original level. In this way, we can actually study the opening and closing of a single IP3 receptor channel, channel in real time. And
how do you know it's a single?
Well, we look at the current trace. If we only see one level throughout the whole experiment, we conclude that it is a single channel. If there is more than one channel, then you will see another channel probably opening on top of the first one, and you will see two levels above the closed channel level.
So this trace is only one?
This trace, actually, in all our experiments, we specifically choose the traces that shows only one current level above that. Well, actually, when the channel open and close very briefly, then the filtering will limit or reduce the channel current level observed. The one that indicates actually the actual current level is one that's actually open long enough so that it attains its highest level.
This is a monovalent current that's measured?
Actually, yes, in our solution, in most of our experiments, unless, again, I point out specifically, both the pipette solution and the bath solution contains 140 millimolar potassium chloride. So since the IP3 receptor is equally, is permeable to both divalent and monovalent cations, and there is such a high concentration of potassium ion, most of the current that is moving through the channel is actually carried by potassium cation. In this way, actually, we have the current that is passing through carries very little calcium. So actually, the calcium concentration near the vicinity of the channel is packed pretty vigorously. With the membrane voltage that we used in our experiment is mostly 20 millivolts, and there is a non-zero leak current passing through the membrane, but we only look at these, the magnitude of the current that is passing through the channel specifically. Any more question? So in this set of experiment, we are looking, we use a high level of IP3 in the pipette solution, 10 micromolar. So as you can see, the channel opens only very briefly and very occasionally in the presence of a low cytoplasmic calcium concentration of about 100 nanomolar.
So the 450 nanomolar, that's outside of the pipette, right? So
right, it's in the bath.
It's in the bath. So this one receptor, this one IP3 receptor you're looking at is in the pipette.
It has the cytoplasmic side facing into the pipette. The luminal side is still,
understand that it's still connected.
Right.
Would there be any calcium going through from the nuclear envelope into the pipette? And what would be the loading state of the nuclear envelope, do you think, under the conditions that you're doing these experiments?
Well, throughout our experiment, we do not see any significant imbalance in the in ionic concentration. So we believe, because we do not have any ATP in our bath solution, so basically we do not expect the calcium pump, if it is present in the nuclear outer nuclear envelope, to function very well. So after the isolation, we expect the calcium concentration to equilibrate between the luminal side of the channel and the bath solution. We haven't done any vigorous experiments, but we haven't seen anything to suggest.
What would be the time scale when this, how long would this nucleus have been sitting in ATP-free medium before you start recording? recording say?
Actually, usually it's about in the minutes, because you know you isolate the channel and then you have to move the isolated nucleus in this bar from where it's the isolation is done over to the experimental setup, and then place a pipette in position. It's about 2 to 3 minutes at least before we start. And we have done these experiments using the isolated nucleus that has been sitting in the bar for over 2 hours, and we do not see any significant difference between at the beginning of the experiment and at the end, 2 hours after it's been exposed. So we conclude, we believe that the cytoplasm, the luminoside calcium is pretty much similar to the bar solution. Okay, so when we increase the cytoplasmic calcium concentration, we see that the activity of the channel increases, and the channel spent more time in the open open state. And
I don't understand why you refer to it as the cytoplasmic calcium concentration, because in answer to Eberhard's question, you said that in the pipette it's isolated from the.
So the actually the cytoplasmic calcium that I refer to is the calcium concentration of the pipette solution, and since the cytoplasmic side of the channel is now seeing the pipette solution, so the cytoplasmic.
You measure inside the pipette.
The solution that we use with the 420 nanomolar is placed inside the pipette. So that is.
Understood your answer for this question.
So yes, the solution, I mean the cytoplasmic calcium or cytoplasmic IP3 concentration is the concentration of these ligands inside the pipette solution. Outside is the 450 nanomolar bath that we expect the channel to see.
And every trace is a new receptor because you have to come in new with a new.
Right, right. We in all our experiments we have not, we do not change the solutions inside the pipette. It's too difficult to do. Yeah. So, and as a result, in every experimental condition, we use a new channel basically, and so all the current response, or the open probability response curve that I'm going to plot out, each data point is made up of at least 4 different experiments using exactly the same experimental condition. Actually, some of them has 20 more or more experiments averaged in it. So the current level increases when we increase the cytoplasmic calcium concentration, and it becomes maximally activated when the cytoplasmic calcium concentration goes beyond 1 micromolar. And the open probability in our experimental system is maximum at about 0.8, so that the channel spend most of its time being open and only briefly close in this condition. And the channel remains maximally activated between the cytoplasmic calcium concentrations of 1 to 20 micromolar. This is different from the observations for the reconstituted channel in the bilayer system. It's very robustly activated, and it's activated over a very wide range of calcium concentration. Finally, if we increase the calcium concentration to beyond 20 micromolar, the channel starts to be inhibited by the cytoplasmic calcium, and by the time you reach 78 micromolar cytoplasmic calcium, the channel open probability becomes significantly reduced. So if we plot the open probability of the channel against the various calcium concentration on the cytoplasmic side, we get this biphasic response curve. At the low calcium concentration range between about 50 nanomolar to 1 micromolar, increase in the cytoplasmic calcium concentration activates the channel up until it reaches a maximum open probability of 0.8. And the channel remains maximally activated between 1 micromolar and 20 micromolar. And then further increase in the cytoplasmic calcium concentration starts to inhibit the channel. The slope of this activating side of the response curve is steep. The Hill coefficient is about 2. so that the activation of the channel by the cytoplasmic calcium is a cooperative process even on the single channel level. On the other side, the inhibition phase of the regulation, the Hill coefficient is even bigger, it's nearly 4, so that the inhibition of the channel by cytoplasmic calcium is also cooperative. I would also like to point out that the affinity for the activating calcium site is pretty high, at so that the half maximal activating calcium concentration is about 200 nanomolar, whereas the affinity for the inhibitory calcium binding site is significantly lower. The half maximal inhibitory calcium concentration is about 60 micromolar in the presence of 10 micromolar IP3. So there is a significant difference in the affinity between the two sites that results in a broad plateau area where the calcium can remain up, maximally activated. Yes?
And how do you draw your conclusion with respect to the affinity? I mean, the half maximal you see, but by the affinity you cannot say anything because, I mean, for example, in the model that people fitted to the single bilayer experiment, you can get bell-shaped curves with the affinity of both sides being equal.
Right.
So you cannot read out the affinity.
Well, I should say the apparent affinity that we see just from this empirical fit using the Hill equation. So the number that we've put in here for the half maximal, this number and that number, has a significant difference in magnitude, put it that way. That's more vigorously put. So let's see. Okay. So the next set of experiments deals with the effect of concentration of IP3 on the IP3 receptor channel activity. So this is the activity, the calcium response curve of the channel in the presence of 10 micromolar IP3. If we further increase the IP3 concentration to 180 micromolar, we see that the activity level of the IP3 at various IP3 receptor at various calcium level is more or less the same as that in the 10 micromolar IP3.
This is IP3 swimming in the pipette there?
Right, swimming in the pipette.
Right, I meant the water in the pipette.
Yeah, in the solution in the pipette, yes. And if we reduce the amount of IP3 present in the pipette solution to 100 nanomolar, we see that the activity level of the IP3 receptor is more or less the same. There's no significant difference. So we conclude that the IP3 receptor is already saturated by IP3 concentration of about 100 nanomolar.
Do you think that if you have full calcium stores, meaning is there a fixed imperative to keep the nuclear store full, that then the channel might see the 100 micromolar much, much sort of lower, you know, apparent concentrations? Do you know what I mean? That the calcium coming, the natural calcium coming through the channel rather than the potassium as a current carrier,
that's possible. And so that's why I emphasize that in our measurement it's a steady state. There is very little calcium moving through the channel. It's very different from the situation in the cell when the channel opens. Obviously the store calcium will rush out, the calcium that the channel C in its vicinity will increase. But in our case, there is no very little change in the calcium that or IP3 concentration that the channel C on the cytoplasmic side. So this study is, to a certain extent, is different from what the actual IP3 receptor sees during a excitation event in the cell. Yes.
In addition to, I'm not sure if Jim is getting that, what would the luminal concentration of calcium be affecting the sensitivity of the IP3 receptor, not just the calcium which is coming out and then acting to inactivate the receptor, but the luminal concentration of calcium? It's down at 450 nanomolar, which is way below.
Way below, yes. We think that it may be, because there is, as pointed out before, there is a luminal calcium binding site. It may be functional. in the IBSA receptor sequence. But we have technical difficulty in having a BAF solution that is very high in calcium concentration. It actually makes it difficult to get this gigaohm seal. So in this set of experiments, we haven't studied the effect of the luminal calcium concentrations. We restrict ourselves mainly to the cytoplasmic calcium concentration. We are at present trying to get an experimental system that allowed us to look at the luminal calcium concentration in a more vigorous way.
Without that, the challenge is almost irrelevant biology.
Well, if you believe, I'm not sure how the luminal calcium affect the channel. So, and we can only say that in this set of experimental condition, this is our observation. It may be relevant if the luminal calcium concentration regulation is similar. I mean, put it in a similar kind of behavior. If it has a new behavior emerging in a high luminal calcium concentration, then yes, we'll have to do the study. Yes.
I thought it may be better equipped than me to answer it, but how do you buffer the free calcium between 10 and 300 micromolar? We find it very difficult to accurately buffer calcium and measure it within that range.
Right. We actually, between this range, we use ATP as a buffer, which is not a very good buffer within that range. Therefore, we measure the free calcium concentration that we use with our pipette solution with a calcium electrode. And we rigorously measure that actually, we measure the calcium free calcium concentration with calcium electrode for every solution that we put in the pipette.
So does that mean that free ATP is a variable along here in concert with calcium
variables? Yes. But the amount, even at this level, we have... by the way, forgot to mention that all the experiments that we've done has about 500 micromolar ATP, total ATP in the system. In the absence of any magnesium or presence. So the free ATP concentration should be somewhere near 500 micromolar at this range, where it's very little calcium to bind to the free ATP. By the time you get to this, the free ATP level goes down to probably somewhere around 400 or 450 micromolar.
ATP because free ATP is a competitive antagonist.
Right, we do not see any difference. We in the solution in the in this concentration range between the solution without ATP, we just simply put in the amount of calcium and we measure it, and some solution that is containing ATP. We have reported there is significant difference effect of ATP on this side, but we are not talking about that in here. Out here, it's getting difficult to do the experiments with or comparing with or without ATP, because as you mentioned, the ATP does help buffer the calcium concentration. And so the ATP concentration and the free calcium concentration is related, and it's difficult to sort of dissect them. We can only say that here is the free calcium concentration we are sure, because we measure it. The ATP we put in, total ATP we know, the free ATP we may work out, and we do not know what the effect of the actual free ATP changes might have in here. So now we move on to further lowering the IP3 concentration to below the 100 nanomolar range. So at 33 nanomolar, at a low cytoplasmic calcium concentration, we see that the open probability of the channel is low, but the channel can be activated maximally to the open probability of 0.8. by the time the cytoplasmic calcium level goes to 1 micromolar. What's interesting is that as we increase the cytoplasmic calcium concentration to 20 micromolar, we see that the channel activity is already significantly inhibited by the calcium. You remember that in the presence of the saturating IP3 concentration, in this calcium concentration level, the channel still is optimally, maximally activated. So if we plot out the calcium response curve of the channel in the presence of 33 nanomolar, we see that the activating side of this curve is very similar for the channel exposed to 33 nanomolar IP3 compared with a saturating level of IP3. What's different is mainly the channel becomes more sensitive to inhibition by cytoplasmic calcium concentration. And the half maximal inhibitory calcium concentration in the presence of 33 nanomolar IP3 is now about 10 micromolar instead of the 60 micromolar in the presence of the 10 micromolar IP3. If we further reduce the IP3 concentration to 20 nanomolar, we see that the channel becomes even more sensitive to inhibition by cytoplasmic calcium, and here it fails to attain its maximum open probability of 0.8, because even before the channel becomes fully activated, it starts to be inhibited by the calcium. So at by the time the IP3 concentration is lower to 10 nanomolar, the channel is even more sensitive to inhibition by calcium, so that channel activity can only be observed if within a very narrow range of calcium concentration. And so we conclude from this that the major effect of IP3 on the IP3 receptor channel is actually to modify the sensitivity of the channel to calcium inhibition. There is very little effect on the activation of the channel by IP3. Now we change gear a little and start and want to look at the spontaneous activity of the IP3 receptor channel in the absence of any activating ligand. So in this set of experiment, we put the IP3 receptor in the presence of a very low level of cytoplasmic calcium, 1 to 2 nanomolar. In the presence of saturating 10 micromolar IP3, we see that even at this low calcium concentration, the channel is active, even though the open probability of the channel is rather low. And what's interesting, more interesting, is that even if we take out all the IP3 in the pipette, the channel still have activity, shows activity, and the open probability of this channel is very similar to the open probability of the channel in the presence of saturating IP3. So this level of channel activity is independent of the presence or the absence of IP3 in the cytoplasmic side. Furthermore, we, in order to make sure that there is no endogenous IP3 lingering on in the vicinity of the channel after it has been isolated, we put a high level of heparin, which is a competitive inhibitor of the IP3 binding to the receptor, inside our pipette, and yet we still see channel activity in this condition, in which there should not be any IP3 bound to the receptor.
This is just a continuation of the trace?
No, no, this is three different experiments.
The two lines, the two bound lines.
Yes, these two lines is a continuous trace. The open probability is so low that you need to look at it for a long time to see the channel activities. So since these activities that we see is occurring independent of the presence of the traditional ligand agonist of the IP3, which is of receptor, so we want to make sure the that we are actually looking at a channel activity of the IP3 receptor. So we measure the conductance of the spontaneous IP3 independent activity, and we see that the conductance is indistinguishable from the conductance of the channel that is activated by IP3. Furthermore, if we put an asymmetrical ionic condition around the membrane patch with 140 millimolar potassium chloride inside the bath and only 14 millimolar potassium chloride in our pipette, the spontaneous channel exhibits a reversal potential of 56 millivolt. And it is very similar to the reversal potential of the channel that is activated by IP3. So we conclude from this that the cation selectivity of our spontaneous activity is identical to the selectivity of the IP3 activated channel. Based on these pieces of evidence, we conclude that the even though we see the spontaneous activity in the absence of IP3, this activity is nonetheless generated by the IP3 receptor. One more. This is because actually the seal conductance is different. So the slope at this point where the channel is closed is the conductance of the seal, the leak current. And this gives a different slope depending on how good the gigaohm is around the isolated membrane patch. So if you actually take this, the slope of this dotted curve and subtract the slope of the continuous curve, which is the baseline current, the difference in between these two slopes and the difference between these two slopes is the same. So one more thing that I would want to point out is that the spontaneous activity that we observe is only seen in the presence of a very low cytoplasmic calcium level. If we increase the cytoplasmic calcium concentration to 25 nanomolar, then in the presence of 10 micromolar IP3, we can still see the channel being active. However, if we do not have any IP3 present, then we never see any channel activity under that condition. So the channel is inactive by the time we get to 25 nanomolar cytoplasmic calcium concentration. Again, we change gear and we look at the activity or behavior of the channel after the IP3 receptor is, sorry.
Spontaneous activity of IP3 receptor that you might find in cells always has to be due to low level IP3 in the cytoplasm. Would you conclude that?
Well, I think from our result, we see a low level of activity of IP3 receptor in a very low calcium concentration. Actually, the calcium concentration that we use is so low, it's 1 to 2 nanomolar, and we never actually expect the IP3 inside the cell to actually experience that kind of low calcium concentration. So to that extent, actually, the experimental condition that we've used to observe the spontaneous activity is non-physiological. So
what's the physiological range?
I guess this is a estimate is somewhere between 10 to 20 nanomolar all the way up to at least 100 nanomolar or even higher if you look at the local IP3 concentration. But the average that has been measured, it suggests that it's somewhere around the tens of nanomolar range in the resting situation. Also, I would like to point out that, again, the experimental condition that we use for these two sets of measurements is somewhat physiological, at least on the cytoplasmic side of the channel. Whereas in this case, and also in the set of experiments that I'm going to talk about, the experimental condition that we have used is actually non-physiological in the sense that we never expect an IP3 receptor actually in the cell to experience that kind of experimental condition. Now, we talk about these sets of observations because they have implications in the selection of the model that I'm going to talk about, and therefore I'm going to present it here as well. So we want to look at the behavior of the IP3 receptor after it has been exposed to an ultra-low calcium concentration. So instead of isolating the nucleus into the standard bath, which has 450 nanomolar calcium, we isolate the oocyte that we use, the nucleus that we use, into a bath containing 1 to 2 nanomolar calcium concentration. And to make sure that the nucleus can fully equilibrate with this low bath calcium concentration, we wait 20 minutes after we have isolated the nucleus into the bath before we start performing any of our patch clamp experiments. So in this experiment, we put 10 micromolar IP3 in the pipette solution, and in the presence of a low calcium concentration, the open probability of the channel is low, and the open probability of the channel increases as we increase the cytoplasmic calcium level until the channel becomes optimally activated by the time the calcium level reaches 1 micromolar and beyond. So far, the behavior of the channel is very similar to that has been isolated into a regular standard calcium bath. However, if we increase the calcium concentration to beyond 20 micromolar, the channel remains maximally activated with an open probability of 0.8. In fact, the channel is totally uninhibited by the cytoplasmic calcium concentration, even at the level of 300 micromolar. So apparently, the inhibition of the IP3 receptor by cytoplasmic calcium is totally disrupted by its exposure to the ultra-low calcium bath. So here I'm showing the calcium response curve of the channel that underwent two different treatment. The channel that has been exposed to the regular standard 450 nanomolar calcium bath, and the channel that has been exposed to the ultra-low calcium bath. You see that the activation side of the channel is similar, and both channels remains maximally activated by cytoplasmic calcium concentration between 1 and 20 micromolar, but whereas the channel that has been exposed to the standard bath starts to be inhibited by cytoplasmic calcium concentration beyond 20 micromolar calcium range. The channel that has been exposed to the ultra-low calcium bath just remain maximally activated even up to a cytoplasmic calcium concentration level of 1 millimolar.
Is your ultra-low solution, do you have magnesium or other divalents there, or it's divalent free?
It's essentially divalent free.
Could this be due to differences in the intraluminal calcium concentration?
It's possible. so we one obvious difference is that the channel is now seeing a luminal calcium concentration that is very different from the one that it's a channel C in the 450 nanomolar bath. The other possibility is that there is this the exposure of the channel before the patch clamping solution, patch clamping experiment is done, is different. So it has seen a very low calcium condition before this this experiment has been performed. So it may be a memory of what it has seen before. Yes.
You seem to have lost the inhibitory side, and also the Hill coefficient of activation increases. It's possible that by having such a low calcium, then you're losing an accessory protein.
It's possible that,
you add EPGA, then any protein which is calcium dependent binding to the IP3 receptor would come off. So you lose the inhibition which has been ascribed to come off there anyway.
Yes, it's possible that this is due to a loss of an accessory protein. Two things I would like to mention is that this effect is totally reversible. So if we put the nucleus back into the regular bath after we've exposed it to this bath, and then perform patch clamp experiment, then we see this behavior, the return of the inhibition by cytoplasmic calcium concentration. And this is also reversible. If we then put the nucleus back to the ultra-low calcium bath, then we see this. So this can be turned on and off. So if we The associated protein is somehow dissociated. It remains in the vicinity of the channel so that when it sees a high calcium again, then it comes back onto the channel to reinstate the calcium inhibition. Also, I would like to point out that we have done control experiments that we overexpress the mutant calmodulin with all the calcium binding sites disabled in the oocyte, and we perform the same experiment, and we see that the those nucleus from those overexpressing oocyte placed in a regular calcium bath will behave like this, and those nucleus that is isolated from those overexpressing nucleus expressing oocyte, if it placed into the low calcium bath, it behaves like that. So this behavior is probably not due to a calmodulin. It may be due to another different associated protein. We cannot rule out that possibility.
Yep. Can you just check out the reversibility? So you're saying the movement in the inhibition is reversible if you change calcium in the bath.
Right.
Not reversible if you change calcium in the pipette.
Okay, when we put the pipette, when we patch on to the channel using a high calcium pipette solution with this calcium concentration, we see the channel activity being very high. So the calcium inhibition is not there, even though the channel is now seeing this kind of calcium concentration in the pipette.
So would that argue for something acting luminally rather than...
That means, yes, that either the thing is, the mechanism is acting luminally, or it has a very long time it needs a long time to do the recovery, which is longer than the normal experimental duration that we do in our patch time experiment, that it shows the activity during the time that we patch without reversing.
I think you could follow that by changing the bath medium as you record from the...
That is very tricky. One of the main thing is that the channel activity that we observe can terminate abruptly after 30 seconds to 1 minute. And it's difficult to change the bath solution completely to our satisfaction within that time window that we can see the channel activity. So let's see. So we have a very interesting situation here, because we have just concluded that the main effect of IP3 on the IP3 receptor channel activity is by modulating the sensitivity of the IP3 receptor to calcium inhibition. Here we have a case where the channel is no longer inhibited by cytoplasmic calcium. So we would like to investigate what kind of IP3 sensitivity or what kind of effect IP3 have on these channel, if any. So we take out all the IP3 in our pipette and we put it in the after we've put the nucleus in the ultra low calcium bath and put in high calcium concentration, we see no activity at all. So even though the channel is not inhibited by cytoplasmic calcium, it's still critically dependent on the presence of IP3 in order to become active. Now, if we put a subsaturating level of IP3 in the pipette, we see that the channel is active in optimal calcium concentration, but its maximum open probability is much lower than what we see in the presence of saturating IP3. However, even in this subsaturating concentration of IP3, we can still see the absence of calcium inhibition. As we increase the cytoplasmic calcium to a high level, the channel remains open, and the open probability is more or less the same as in the optimal calcium concentration. So if we look at the calcium response curve here, we see that in all IP3 concentrations, the channel remains uninhibited by cytoplasmic calcium. And the main effect of the reduction of IP3 concentration is to reduce the maximum open probability that the channel can exhibit in these conditions. And one more point that I would like to point out is that when the channel is exposed to the standard calcium bath in the saturating IP3 optimal calcium concentration, the maximum open probability of the channel is about 0.8. It's less than 1. We can argue that this is because the channel is still a little bit inhibited by the calcium in this concentration. However, in this case where we isolated the nucleus into the ultra low calcium bath, there is no inhibition by high calcium concentration. And yet, if we look at the channel and saturating IP3 and a very high calcium concentration such that the IP3 binding site and the calcium activating site should be totally occupied, the open probability that we see is still less than 1, is 0.8. So now we come to the modeling of the IP3 receptor channel gating. The model that we want to look at is must account for these functional observations. First, for a nucleus that is isolated into the regular standard 450 nanomolar calcium bath, it must be biphasically regulated by the cytoplasmic calcium concentration. It is regulated by IP3 by mainly changing its half-maximal inhibitory calcium concentration, that is its sensitivity to cytoplasmic calcium inhibition, and it does not affect significantly the calcium activation parameters. Also, the sensitivity to the IP3 effect is very high over a narrow range of IP3 concentration. The half-maximal calcium inhibitory calcium concentration changes from about 150 nanomolar in the presence of 10 nanomolar IP3 all the way up to 60 micromolar in the presence of 100 nanomolar IP3. So it changes two orders of magnitude, and it's very so the channel is actually designed in such a way that it is very responsive to a very small change in the IP3 concentration. So that's the effect of IP3 saturate very abruptly. So beyond 100 nanomolar, even if we increase the IP3 concentration by over three orders of magnitude to 180 micromolar, there is no significant change in the activity level of the channel in any calcium concentration. Finally, we also see the spontaneous activity of the IP3 receptor in the ultra-low calcium level in the absence of any IP3. So in this case, the channel is active even when its activating calcium binding site and its IP3 binding site should both be unoccupied. On the other hand, for the channel that is isolated in the ultra-low calcium bath, we see that the channel activity, the channel is activated within the low calcium concentration range in a very similar manner as those that is exposed to the regular calcium bath. And however, the inhibition of the channel by cytoplasmic calcium is totally disrupted, and the channel still remains critically dependent on the presence of IP3 for its activity. And in the subsaturating IP3 concentration, the IP3 concentration mainly affects the maximum open probability of the channel. And finally, even with the full abrogation of the high calcium concentration inhibition, we see that the channel can only have a maximum open probability of 0.8. It's less than 1. Also, besides taking into account all the previous experimental observations, The channel must also, I would like to have a channel that takes into account the what is known about the molecular structure of the IP3 receptor channel. That is, the functional IP3 receptor channel is a tetramer made up of four IP3 receptor molecules. And in the case of the Xenopus oocyte IP3 receptor channel, it is a homotetramer because there's only the type 1 IP3 receptor. So all four of the molecules is type 1 IP3 receptor molecules. Also, there have been multiple potentially functional calcium binding sites identified along the primary sequence of the IP3 receptor molecule. However, there is only one IP3 binding site identified in the sequence near the N-terminal. So this one IP3 binding site in the channel is responsible to generate the extremely high sensitivity of the IP3 receptor to the variation of IP3 concentration. So look at different classes of models that can be considered. First, the simplest one is the sequential model in which the channel is closed until it binds to a activating ligand, and then the channel, the ligand-bound channel can open. However, our observation that the IP3 receptor can spontaneously open even in the absence of IP3 or at this activating calcium binding site is empty. So we rule out this class of model, and we have to go and look at the allosteric model in which the channel can exist at least in two conformations, a tight closed conformation and a relaxed openable conformation, even in the absence of any activating ligand. So the channel is mostly existing in the tight conformation when the ligand is absent, but however, it can move into the openable relaxed conformation with a low probability, and this generates the spontaneous activity. The binding of ligand to the channel shifts the equilibrium to the openable relaxed conformation so that the channel now can open more frequently, and this serves as the activation of the channel by the ligand. We define the simplest model for the IP3 receptor channel as the one that involves the fewest three parameters. And we've finally come to the conclusion that an allosteric model based on the Monod-Wyman-Chagall model is the one that can give us the simplest model with the fewest three parameters. This is because the MWC model has several simplifications that it has assumed in order to reduce the number of parameters involved. First of all, it assumes that all the monomers in a tetrameric channel has to change its conformation in a concerted manner. So this kind of conformation where in which only one of the monomer exists in one conformation whereas the other exists in yet another conformation is not allowed in this model. Also, all the equivalent binding site inside the same tetrameric channel has to have the same affinity for the ligand. When the channel changes conformation, then the site may have a different affinity from the one before. However, within the same channel, the affinity of the site remains the same. Also, when ligand binds to the channel, it will specifically stabilize the channel which has a binding site that has a high affinity for that that ligand, so that the presence of the ligand will stabilize the channel which binds better to the ligand and shift the equilibrium towards that conformation. And that is the way that the ligand, the only way that the ligand affects the equilibrium position between the two conformations. And finally, the affinity of any ligand binding site in the channel is not affected by the binding of a ligand. What I mean is, when this ligand binds to this binding site, any other binding site in the same monomer remains the same affinity. And the other monomers, in the other monomers, the ligand binding sites still have the same affinity. So there is no change in the affinity of any ligand due to the binding of the ligand to one site. Also, the implication of these simplification is that even though there are four different monomers, each set of ligand binding sites functions independent of others. So I'm going to go over some simple MWC models to orient ourselves to the representation, because the model that I'm going to finally end up with is rather complicated. So in the simplest case of the MWC model, we have a monomeric channel with two conformations binding to one single ligand. So we have two different ligand binding states, one without any ligand and one bound to the ligand. And this is the binding of the ligand. This represents the binding of the ligand to the channel. And there are two conformations, and the conformations is always in equilibrium, represented by the white arrow. And the ligand is binding. The change in the conformation always occurs in between two conformations with the same number of ligand bound to it. Now, if we look at a more complicated case where we have two kinds of ligand binding to two independent ligand binding states in a model with a monomeric channel with two conformations, we see that there are four different ligand binding states, and for each conformation, and the equilibrium between the conformations exists between two conformations that have the same ligand binding state. So there are four different equilibriums involved. Now we look at a tetrameric channel. So even with just two ligand binding to the tetrameric channel, we have five different ligand binding states for each ligand with 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4 ligand binding to the channel. And on this side, we have the ligand binding to another ligand binding to another ligand binding site. So we end up with 25 different ligand binding states for one conformation and another 25 on the other. So you can see this can be getting complicated very rapidly as we consider more ligand binding. So we focus on the fact that this channel model involves only two conformations. So we represent all the ligand binding states on this side and simplified it by representing it with one symbol. Similarly, all the 25 ligand binding states of this conformation we represent with an other symbol. And we represent all the 25 equilibriums between the two conformations with one white arrow, which actually is 25 different equilibria between those conformations with the same ligand binding state. So this is the MWC model involving two conformations. Here, before we move on, we have to think about actually how many functional calcium binding sites we need in order to account for the experimental observations that we have seen so far. There must be one activating binding site, which we call the F site, in order to activate that is responsible for the activation of the channel at 200 nanomolar calcium. And this site is stipulate is IP3 independent, because IP3 does not change the activating character of the channel a lot. Also, there must be an inhibitory calcium binding site, which we call the H site, for the inhibition of the channel in the presence of high cytoplasmic calcium. Now, this site should become non-functional after the channel is exposed to the ultra-low calcium bath, because the inhibition of the channel by high calcium concentration is totally disrupted by this maneuver. And yet, we notice that the channel is still inactivated in the absence of IP3. So in the presence of a activating site, there must be a counteracting inhibitory site, which we call the G site, that is inhibitory in the absence of IP3, that suppresses the channel activity when there is no IP3 present. And it is this site that is IP3 dependent. So in this model, we conclude that each IP3 receptor monomer must have at least three functional calcium binding sites on the cytoplasmic side. So we know that the MWC model, the simplest MWC model, involves two conformations. One is the open conformation and the other one is a closed conformation. And in the tetrameric IP3 receptor, we know that there is one IP3 binding site, so there are five IP3 binding states in the tetrameric channel. And for each of the three calcium binding states, calcium binding sites, there are five different calcium binding states. So there are a total of 625 different ligand binding states for this conformation. Similarly, this conformation has 625 different ligand binding states, and we have a 625 different ligand conformation changes represented by that arrow. So the simplest model for the IP3 channel gating involves actually six different conformations. And the question is, why six? So we return to the simplest two conformation MWC model with an open conformation and a closed conformation. Ligand binding to the channel will affect the position of the equilibrium between the two conformations. In the absence of ligand, the channel exists mostly in the closed conformation, and therefore they have only a low open probability resulted from the occasional move of the channel into the open conformation. However, any ligand that stabilizes the open conformation can activate the channel independent of the other ligand. So say if this ligand binds to the channel and shift the equilibrium, So binds to the channel and shift the equilibrium to the open state, then even in the absence of this ligand, if another ligand can bind to the channel and stabilize this state, it will equally activate the channel. However, our observation is that in the saturating IP3 concentration, in the low calcium concentration, there is very low channel open probability. Conversely, even in the presence of a lot of calcium, if you have a very low IP3 concentration, the channel is still not fully activated. So neither IP3 nor calcium alone can activate the channel. And so we cannot use this simple two conformation model to account for our observation. So we moved on to this model, which is based on the MWC model with four conformations. Two of them is closed, the B and the D, and the A and C conformation is open. We further stipulate for simplicity that these two equilibrium is actually dependent on IP3 only, and calcium doesn't affect the position of these two equilibrium. And these two equilibria is affected by calcium only, and IP3 doesn't affect the position. So in this way, the IP3 activation and the calcium effect on the channel is delineated. How does that work? So if we consider the IP3 binding to the channel, the affinity of the IP3 binding site for the channel in the C conformation is higher than the site's affinity for in the A conformation. So IP3 binding will favor this conformation. Similarly, IP3 binding with a higher affinity to the D conformation than to the B conformation. And so IP3 binding to the channel will favor this conformation over the other. However, the IP3 affinity for the A conformation and the B conformation is the same. So the presence or absence of IP3 does not affect this, the position of this equilibrium. And similarly, the IP3 affinity for these two conformations are the same. So IP3 concentration has no effect on the position of this equilibrium. On the other hand, the affinity for calcium of the F site is higher in the A conformation compared with the B conformation. And the affinity for the F site in the C conformation is higher than that in the D conformation. So IP3 binding to the F site favors the open A or C conformation relative to the closed B or D conformation. In that sense, the F site is activating because calcium binding to this site will cause the channel to open more. Along the same line, the H site has a higher affinity in the B conformation and the D conformation relative to the A and C conformation respectively. So calcium binding to the H site actually favors the closed B conformation or the D conformation, causing the channel to close, resulting in the inhibition. Most interestingly, if we look at the equilibrium between the A and the B conformation, the calcium affinity for the G site in the B conformation is higher than that in the A conformation. So in this equilibrium, the G site is inhibitory. However, the G site in the C conformation and the D conformation is higher than the D conformation. So IP3 binding to the G site actually favors the open C conformation in this equilibrium. And looking at this equilibrium, the G site is activating. So how does all these work together in various experimental conditions? We look at the absence of IP3 first. In the absence of IP3 binding to its site, the channel actually favors the A and B conformation. So most of the time, the equilibrium is shifted towards the A and B side. So the channel exists mainly in the A and B conformations. In this equilibrium, what is the effect of calcium? So first, in a very low calcium concentration within, you know, near the 2 nanomolar, we see that none of the calcium binding site is occupied. The naturally, the channel favors existence in the B conformation, so the channel is closed most of the time with a very low open probability, resulting from the occasional occasional existence of the channel in the open A conformation. So this result in our observed spontaneous activity of the channel in the absence of any ligand bound to this channel. And so this is the relatively low level of open probability here. Now, when we further look at the effect of calcium, among the three calcium binding sites in the two conformation, the G site that is in the B conformation has the highest affinity. So the G site is inhibitory, and as we increase the calcium concentration from 1.5 nanomolar to 25 nanomolar, the calcium binding to the G site in the B conformation first, and this stabilizes the B conformation and further reduces the effect open probability of the channel, and we see that the open probability is decreased, and at 25 nanomolar, the channel activity is so low that it's not observable. That's there. And even though the F site in the A conformation is the next highest affinity, so that the F site is activating, but its effect is not enough to counter the inhibition by the G site. So as a result, we do not see any channel activity with a higher calcium concentration than the 1.5 nanomolar. IP3 binding to the channel stabilizes the C and the D conformation relative to the A and B conformation. So in the presence of saturating In the presence of saturating IP3 concentration, the equilibrium is shifted all the way to the CND state, so the channel only exists in this equilibrium. Now, in low calcium concentration, when none of the calcium is binding site is occupied, the channel naturally exists mostly in the D conformation. But again, there is a low chance, but non-zero, probability that the channel can enter into the open C conformation, and therefore we have the low and yet detectable open probability of the channel in the low calcium concentration range. As the among the three calcium binding sites in the both conformation, the G site in the C conformation and the F site in the C conformation has the highest affinity. So both the G and the F site are now activating. As the calcium concentration increases, the calcium first binds to the G site in the C conformation and then to the F site in the C conformation, both stabilizing the C conformation. And we have an increase in the open probability as the channel is activated. So this generates the activating curve of the IP3 receptor. Now, as the calcium concentration is further increased to beyond 20 micromolar, then calcium starts to bind to the H site in the D conformation, and thereby stabilizing the D conformation. And this causes the channel to be inhibited by the high cytoplasmic calcium concentration. So the three sites, the F, G, and H site, works together to bring about the biphasic calcium regulation of the IP3 receptor channel. Things get more interesting when we look at the subsaturating IP3 concentration. As the IP3 concentration increases from the 0 to 100 nanomolar, what essentially happens is that the G site changes from being an inhibitory site between the A and B equilibrium to being an activating site in the equilibrium between the C and the D conformation. So, as we increase the IP3 concentration, we start seeing the starting of the activating effect of the G site. And as the IP3 concentration increases, the G site becomes more and more activating. And so at this level, 100 nanomolar IP3, both the G site and the F site is now fully functioning as the activating site, and the channel becomes maximally activated. And then, and because of the change of this nature of the G site, this causes a big change in the calcium response of the channel, and this results in the high sensitivity of the channel to the change in IP3 concentration within the narrow range. Also, as the G site is being changed from the inhibitory to the activating, the effect of the F site at this region starts to be unmasked, so that you can see the F site's activation clearly. And because the F site is IP3 independent, so the activating side of the channel response curve is not significantly affected once the IP3 concentration increased beyond a certain level. Finally, as the G site becomes activating, then we start to see the inhibitory effect of the H site at a very high calcium concentration at about 60 micromolar range. And any further increase in the IP3 concentration has no effect on the inhibition by the H site, because the H site is IP3 independent. So this caused the abrupt saturation of the IP3 receptor to any further increase in the IP3 concentration. So this is the fit of our model to the experimental data. You see that the trend of the behavior is replicated successfully by the model. As the IP3 concentration increases, you see the main change as the channel becomes more less sensitive to the calcium inhibition, and this occurs over a narrow range of IP3. And as the IP3 goes beyond 100 nanomolar, there is no further increase in the calcium response curve. However, how does this look for the channel that is exposed to ultra-low calcium bar? In this model, the affinity of the H site in the C and D conformation becomes the same after the channel is exposed to the calcium bar. This, at this stage, we only can conclude that this is done through some mechanism that we have not characterized fully. And so as a result, the H site becomes not functional. And this gives us the abrogation of the calcium inhibition by the exposure of the channel to low calcium bath. So we see that the channel remains maximally activated even in the presence of high cytoplasmic calcium. The affinities of the F and the G sites are not affected by the maneuver, and therefore the activating side of the calcium response curve remains very similar to that of the channel exposed to the standard bar. Finally,
have you read that the affinities of the G and H sites became the same?
The affinity of the H site in the C and D conformation becomes the same. It was put in, yeah, because we need to eliminate the inhibition, and one way is to eliminate the functional H site, and that's what we did here. So without the functional H site, the maximum channel open probability is determined by the G site, which is the IP3 dependent site. And so as the IP3 concentration is reduced, the channels, as he's shown here, shows no inhibition by high calcium concentration, and yet its open probability, maximum open probability, is reduced as the channel, as the G site gradually becomes more inhibitory when the IP3 concentration is reduced. So this is the fit of the model to the experimental data, and you see that again the trend of the behavior of the channel is reproduced. The fit is not exactly very good. In this model, we have, including the change in the H site, we have I think 18 something like. Yeah.
You're not going to write down a model, are you?
No. If you want, I can present it. I can send the model to you, but I don't think that I want to go through the mathematical derivation of the model here. So we see that the model is not exactly reproducing the experimental data, and it has a problem because, according to this model, after the channel is exposed to the ultra-low calcium bath, there is no more calcium inhibition. So in the presence of saturating IP3, in which both the so that both the F site and the G sites are now activating, and in the presence of very high calcium concentration, so that both the F site and the G sites are bound, we have no inhibitory effect. And so we expect, according to the model, that the channel open probability should go to 1 when all the channel now exists in the activated open C state, and not 0.8. So in order to accommodate that, we stipulate that the channel, even in the open state, can go into a closed state, A prime and a closed C prime state conformation. And the equilibrium between the A and A prime and C prime state, this equilibria is ligand independent. So that even though all the ligand binding conditions is favorable and the channel exists in the A and C conformation and no, not in the B and D conformation, the channel still can close via this equilibria. And this allowed us to introduce one extra free parameter into the modeling, and we can put the limit, the maximum open probability of the channel to 0.8 instead of 1. And here we have a much better fit of the model to the experimental data. And especially when you look at the channel that is exposed to low calcium bath. So in conclusion, we have proposed a MWC-based six conformation allosteric model that successfully fit all the steady state single channel gating property that has been observed, the regulation of the channel by calcium and IP3, and also it allows the generation of spontaneous channel activities even when the channel is not bound to any ligand, and it accounts or it accommodates the disruption of high calcium inhibition of the IP3 receptor gating. We also, the model takes into account the tetrameric structure of the IP3 receptor and allows the cooperative behavior of the calcium activation and inhibition of the channel. And the model also indicates that whereas each IP3 receptor monomer has only one IP3 binding site, it has at least three distinct calcium binding sites, only one of which is IP3 dependent. So that's the state of modeling. Is there any question? Yep.
I mean, in a sense, the question that was asked about how many free parameters there are is not perhaps quite the right question, because in a sense there are an infinite number of free parameters. I mean, you answered there are 18. That's probably because, roughly speaking, you did 18 experiments and you introduced probably a parameter to fit each one. I may be wrong, but that may be it. I think the question is, are there any predictions that result from your model? I mean, that where the parameters are fixed and you see what the model gives. In other words, you adjusted the model to fit the experiment.
Right.
Then you want to ask, are there any qualitative or quantitative predictions which you will test without change of parameters?
So far, I mean, when we look at the modeling, we try to take into consideration all the observed experimental observations.
And that's the right thing to do, but yeah. I think what you want to ask yourself is, can you somehow prove the model wrong or prove the model right by saying, well, if we do some other experiment, then obviously our model isn't good enough, so we can introduce another parameter and make it more complicated, but to see whether the model constrains your experiments, whether you can predict something which follows without further adjustment.
Well, in this case, I think we have, again, as I said, we have looked at all the experiments that has been done. The next experiment that we would like, probably needs to do in order to sort of look outside the experimental condition that we have defined is maybe mutagenesis, trying to find where these F, G, and H site is and see whether we can specifically knock out one of those sites and see whether the channel behaves as if, that in a fashion, corresponding fashion. This is a difficult, but in our model, as I said, we predicted the existence of the F, G, and H site, and the H site is independent of the F site or the G site. So if we can specifically knock out the H site, I suppose, then you should see the abrogation of the calcium inhibition. And also, I mean, if we can specifically knock out the F site, then we predict that the G site will still behave and responds to the IP3 concentration. And so again, you know, if we can isolate the sites, then that's just one way of sort of seeing.
So the main qualitative prediction is the existence of these three sites.
Right. And also the independence, that they are independent. Also, let's see, that would be one way of proving it. But I think the other thing that when I was developing the model I have in mind is hopefully we can use the model to sort of hang all these experimental observations sort of under the same framework. And I was hoping, again, coming to the conference, that maybe someone can take this model and use, you know, go on to look at some more, you know, the behavior of a cluster of channel behaving, you know, in this way, and see whether there is any similarity between the cluster of model behavior to the actual observations beyond the single channel level. That's something that I'm really interested in getting at. The model in itself, I think, account, as I would like to stress, account is derived mainly to account for the single channel observation, and if we can expand it to some, you know, cooperative activity of a cluster of channel, that would be very exciting. Yes.
I mean, what you presented were mainly steady state.
Right.
Data. I mean, it's complicated enough. Very well, but from the perspective of modeling calcium signals that actually occur in cells, kinetics are important, the kinetics of the transitions. Is there any way by doing the measurements you do to infer time scales of transitional changes, for example?
Yes. So at this point, because of the limitation of the patch clamp's experimental setup, it's difficult to change the pipette solution. We are putting a major effort in trying to get a different configuration in our experiment, whereby we can actually get the cytoplasmic side of the channel exposed to the outside of the pipette, and hopefully in that case we can do a rapid perfusion kind of experiment. However, I would also like to point out that our model also can can be an alternative interpretation of Colin's observation, because in his observation he said that in the absence of IP3, the calcium can only bind to the inhibitory site. The activating site is not available for calcium binding until the IP3 site is occupied, and then calcium can then bind to the activating site, and he see the lag time in the activation of the channel. Here in this model is actually in the absence of IP3, there is no activating site. There is only a G site, which is inhibitory, that the that the calcium can bind to, and therefore you see that there is no binding to the activation site because the nature of the site has changed. When IP3 comes along, the binding of the IP3 shifts the equilibrium, and the G site now becomes the activating site that the calcium can bind to and subsequently then activates the channel. So some of his measurement may provide a time scale for the kind of kinetic modeling, because in that case I would say that the lag time represents the time that the time involved in the binding of the IP3 to the IP3 binding site and the conformation change, you know, one way of the channel from the AB configuration conformation into the CD conformation. And so that is a kind of a time scale involved in those those reactions. And with the that is a forward reaction, and our modeling provides the equilibrium constant, so you can figure out the reverse rate constant. So it's that kind of experiment. Yes, we should be able to, if we can, in future do. Yes. It is complicated, we actually in our modeling we specifically left out any effects of the luminal possible luminal calcium concentration effect, because again under our experimental concept there is some, one thing is that in our experiment, we assume that in our modeling, we left the luminal sites sort of conspicuously out of the picture, and alluded to a possible luminal effect when we switch off the H site. There may be more than that effect from the luminal calcium binding, more than just the effect on the H site. Difference in the behavior of the model derived from Zervina's luminal calcium binding, and I don't want to stick. we should talk about that a little bit further later on. I have to refresh my memory of the model that Zervina proposed before I talk too much detail into that. Yes.
Your model of analysis was based, I think, just entirely on the measure of the open.
Right.
It strikes me you're throwing away a wealth of
data. Oh, yes. Yes.
Does that fit with the model or test the model?
Yes, actually, I agree. The reason why we sort of just focused on the open probability one thing is that it's complicated enough just looking at the equilibrium. Basically the open probability is a measurement of the equilibrium between the various conformations and ligand binding states. And that's complicated enough. And we have more information in our experimental data, like the mean time that the channel spend in the open state and the mean time that it spend in the closed state, and how that depends on the IP3 and calcium concentration. We are limited by the experimental technique that we apply to, because as has been pointed out before, in each of our experiments, we have studying only one specific set of experimental conditions in one channel. I would have more confidence in saying what the effect of, say, variation in IP3 has on the channel mean open state distribution if we can look at the same channel as we vary the calcium concentration or as we vary the IP3 concentration. We have noticed that the kinetics of the channel is less reproducible from channel to channel, even under the same experimental condition, than the open probability. And so at this level, we just want to just focus on the really reproducible parameters, because when you look at different channel, you can always say, okay, this channel is has a different environment as from the other channel that we looked at in the different patch, and so comparing between those may not be as easy as we would like.
The same objection would apply to PO?
The PO is more reproducible, as I said. So if you, from patch to patch, you see kinetics may be more varied, but the open probability doesn't change that much. The kinetics might be different, but then the activation energy may be different in the slightly different, but the energy difference between the two states is more reproducible or more well controlled, put it that way. So that's why we just restrict ourselves to that.
I was wondering whether the E2100 mutant described previously by, change the inhibition of the atmosphere satellite, you could fit that data to your model.
We would like to be able to do to get the mutant into our experimental system and look at it with the same experimental condition as we do. As I pointed out before, the behavior of the IP3 receptor in our experimental system with the isolated nuclear patch clamping is different. I mean, even the wild type channel is different from those reconstituted IP3 receptor channel behaving in a artificial lipid bilayer membrane. So we are not sure whether the behavior of the mutant in our experimental system is like. We're not sure what it will look like. And so we wouldn't venture in trying to fit that into our model unless we can observe those mutants in the same experimental condition as we do, because just by the different presumably just environmental effect on the IP3 receptor seems to have a large impact on the behavior of the channel. So we are not sure whether this, the same shift that is observed in the bilayer system can be duplicated in our system. Yes, and no, actually, nature happens to want to be able to do that for us. In our oocyte system, one of the bane of the experiment is that there are periods where we can see a lot of IP3 receptor in the outer nuclear membrane, and therefore the data just pour in. But then there are periods where you patch and patch and patch in different nucleus from different oocytes, even from different frogs. There's still no, you can't see the endogenous channel anywhere in the nucleus. And so we can presumably go and select those periods and do an expression of the mutant, and then we can be reasonably sure that whatever channel that we see in the nucleus in those periods is unlikely to be the endogenous channel, it's probably the expressed mutant channel. We should be able to do that, but there is no control that we can exert on the frog to make them do one way or the other. It's totally under some mysterious factor. And so that experiment is doable, but it's very laborious. And so we are trying to look at different ways to achieve that besides the oocyte nuclear system. So yes, I mean, we want to very much to do that experiment, but hopefully in a less laborious manner. So that is in the list of things to do.
So maybe we need to follow the discussion to the coffee break. Yeah. One of the million thoughts.
Thank you.